Does anyone have any questions? Okay, so the title of the talk this afternoon is What is Left to Hear? And it comes from another koan. Which I'll read at the beginning to you. There was a woman who was not a nun, not a Buddhist nun, but she was practicing with a Buddhist Zen master. Her name was Asan. And it's included in the koan, describing her devotion to her practice. It says she was unremitting, and I'll tell you what that means, unremitting in her devotion to practice. Unremitting would be, it's funny that they would use that word. Kind of unstoppable. Not giving up. And so even before we hear the story, already feeling what that would be like, that even when we feel like giving up, we don't give up. Even when things would seem to come in the way and stop us, there's not stopping. Even when there seems to be going backwards, there's just staying with some kind of fluid continuity. So, and unremitting in her devotion to practice, not just unremitting in her practice. So I like that they make the longer sentence. Unremitting in her devotion to practice. So maybe sometimes she didn't know what to practice. She didn't know exactly where her practice was going. But her devotion to practice, so the way that something in her felt a pull to keep putting into practice her deepest wisdom, her deepest love, her deepest understanding, knowing of life, her deepest aliveness. One day during her morning sitting, she heard the crow of a rooster. Does everyone know what a rooster is? I don't know how your English is. The male chicken. It's usually not considered to be a beautiful song. One day, and it wouldn't have been the first day she'd heard the rooster also. So the rooster is known for always being there every morning. But one day, during her morning sitting, she heard the crow of the rooster, and her mind suddenly opened. So I love the ordinariness, because some of the Zen stories, there's something like the full moon light in the bucket or whatever, and this is just she was meditating in the morning and a rooster crowed. And suddenly her mind opened. And I love the descriptions, her mind suddenly opened. So we have the sense that it's suddenly opening, but it's not as if there haven't been all those mornings before and all those evenings before and all that devotion and practice unremittingly. And the mind opened. It didn't just sort of break or go to the star called whatever. The mind suddenly opened. She spoke a verse in response. So she said something, and to call it a verse means that it's like a poem or a song. But basically, some words came out of her mouth. And these were the words: the fields, the mountains, the flowers, and my body too, are the voice of the bird. What is left that can be said to hear? And her teacher, Tetsumon, acknowledged her enlightenment. The fields, the mountains, the flowers, and my body too, are the voice of the bird. What is left that can be said to hear? The fields, the mountains, the flowers, and my body too, are the voice of the bird. What is left that can be said to hear? So this is a talk really about letting go and questioning what letting go is. Wondering about what it means to let go and why people consider letting go to be so important. So the first thing I want to bring in is a modern Zen experience, which was a scientific study of some Zen meditators who had quite some experience. And probably the people had their brains wired up to some machine or whatever. And this time it wasn't the voice of a bird, it was the voice of a bell. And the bell was just ringing. Someone was ringing the bell and then ringing the bell again. And ringing the bell again, and people were just meditating with wires sticking to their head. It would be a fun game. This could be like a new party game. Could all guess, what do you think they found in the study? What was the big, what's the koan that you could make out of that story? Which is anyway a hilarious picture of people sitting in Zen with wires to their brain. As if the brain really is the thing that we should be looking at. But anyway, that's what they were looking at. And in the brains of some of the meditators hearing the bell, there was no change in the response of the brain to the bell. Every time was like the first time. So the 20th time that the brain heard the bell, the brain really heard the bell. So it always gets a little tricky whenever we say something specific, like this specific modern scientific Zen koan. It can so easily be taken in as an instruction that we should listen to the voice of the bird or the bell or both, always. And that isn't actually the instruction. But at the same time, if we open our minds to the two stories a little bit, and feel, for example, what it would be like to hear a bell for the first time, or what it has been like when you heard the sound of a bird. And it was your body in the mountains and the fields. So when it was just a sound of any kind, a bell or a rooster or a woodpecker, and it just so happened that there was no screen between your body and the voice of the bell. So there was some kind of freshness or wonder, or it opened out a space. where time had a really different quality. So either time was really elastic, the sound seemed to go on in slow motion forever, and you could always go back to that. You can feel that feeling now if your mind is open to let you remember a moment like that, your own moment like that. So instead of listening in the way that we hear how wrong we are and how easily we get bored by hearing the same thing over and over again, but if we could just let those times come across now or later, when there was like, as if the first time, the bell, even when it definitely wasn't the first time. So what isn't there when it's like the first time? So what is the quality like? What does it feel like? What happens? And I'm suggesting that there can seem to be a lot of space. There's also something about beauty. You can call it sweetness or beauty or whatever you want to call it. And it's not that the sound is more beautiful than yesterday. So what is it that is happening when it's as if the first time, but isn't? So first of all, it gives us permission to kind of slow down, that we don't have to actually try to find that tricky new sound to make us get right. It's not particularly about the sound being a new sound, or even a special sound. But what is it? What is let go of? We can play with that, with even something like the breath. It can be a little more tricky or sticky because we don't have the feeling that, like a sound, something that's outside of me. So we start to feel that I'm controlling my breath, and maybe I am, and then I think it's not natural, and we get all tangled up. But even if we just let it be however it is, this breath, even if it's tangled up with, I'm not sure if I'm making it longer or shorter, or deeper or shallower. And even if we think, oh, I'm controlling my breath, I'm making it deeper and longer, or I'm making it shallower, and that's a problem. And even if we would say, well, let me make it even more shallow and short. Let me make it even more problematic. So what? It doesn't actually, it's not any fundamental difference. The rooster that morning might have had a cold, or a sore throat. Asan might have had a cold or a sore throat. She might have been cold. She might have been hot. Jay Krishnamurti talks about how the thinking feeling mind, let's say, the mind that's all woven together with emotions and thoughts, has learned to be careful, he says. He tells us, your mind has learned to be careful, to be cunning, which means to be kind of tricky, to be looking out for what's for my benefit. What can I get out of this? So your mind, which means all of us here, so our mind has learned to be careful, to be cunning, to act as a signal, to give a warning. Your mind has learned to act as a signal, to give a warning. Therefore, you cannot meet any incident fully. So I think this is such a good description of the way our training of our mind now, the way our mind acts. It's learned, it's just learned to be careful. And it's just learned to be cunning, and it's just learned to act as a signal, hey, watch out. To give a warning. Therefore, we cannot meet any incident fully. When we let that statement kind of sit right in us, right inside us, our work is very simple. To find out where there could be a fluid way of moving in the world that's not about being careful. So the work is not even so much to try to convince the mind to be less careful. It's not about entering into conversation with our careful mind and our cunning mind that is trying to get something out of the situation for me because I have problems. The poor mind is doing its best to give us signals, watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out, the whole time. And so our job is, okay, let it do that. If it is on, let it be on. If there's a way, sometimes we can let it go off or notice when it is off because it can't be on all the time. But when it's on, still, life goes on. There's so much more that's still going along. Bells and roosters and mountains and fields and ears. So it's partly learning, letting some other part of us learn to disregard the mind. Disregard warning, that kind of warning. And then to discover what else is. So it's not like we try to keep the mind off to one side quiet enough so that then we can make something else happen. Okay, does that make sense? It's not like repressing the mind and its warning and its worry so that then we can be busy in some other way. It's letting ourselves fall into life, fall in love with life again, remembering where we are in love with life. And so then even from there, we can feel how the mind starts to reach up to try to send a signal. We can let that whole movement of the mind happen if necessary. But meanwhile, feeling something else is happening that we don't have to make up and that we don't have to contain and control. It already is, in a way, self-containing at the same time that it is has an expansive quality, a spacious quality. There's a physicist named Brian Swim who talks about the universe. And so this might be one of those theories that in 1 year, 20 years, 200 years, we would look back on and laugh at, like we do now when people used to think the Earth was the center of the universe, etc. But I think there's something in the description, the experience or the understanding of the universe, that has a lot to tell us about our living, our experience, and our practice, and what that kind of unremitting devotion to practice is like Asan had. I like also that the name, even though it's not an Indian name, Asan in India could mean either easy, Asan is easy, and also like place or seat. So it's in India has the feeling both of easygoing, that kind of more spacious quality, and also here, steady and still. And that's the kind of qualities of the universe. So they talk about, since Einstein, there's talk about the curvature of space and time, which for my own lack of studies, I just receive it in a kind of Zen kind of way. Yeah, sure, curvature of space and time. Like mountains can walk in Zen poetry, and my body can be the voice of the bird along with the fields. The curvature of space and time. It has apparently this really precise relationship, a really precise angle, let's say, that Swim says if it would be the tiniest fraction of a whatever bigger, so any tiny bit more expansive, and everything would fall apart, which would mean that it would all explode in these big sparks. And any tiny bit smaller, so any tiny bit sort of less curved, everything would collapse into a giant black hole. So there's this sense of a curve that the way things are is curved in this way that it's both fully expansive and fully coherent, like holding together. And if we feel the quality of that experience of the first time we heard the bell, even though it was the 50th time that we heard the bell, or that we felt the breath, the millionth time, that quality of the freshness and the not quite mine, not mine feeling of this in-breath, this out-breath. There's a sense of unstoppable expansiveness, openness. Which I think is the quality that more often comes across to us, a sense of spaciousness and expansiveness. Because more often our experience is of feeling stuck and confined. And so then the contrast of those moments are sort of genuine living, meeting, as Krishnamurti would say, meeting our experience fully. But if we feel it's expansiveness and there's a kind of staying, there's a connection. So there's gravity and levity, gravity and uplifting, things are not just flat pancake. It's gravity and holding apart and holding together. Expansiveness and love, we could say. And if it doesn't come now, then let it come later, a memory of a moment, or let the moment come fresh, where it's just this breath, not yours and not yours, but really belonging to life, coming out of nowhere. And every single second, every single half second, every single quarter second, it's arriving and leaving, arriving and leaving, arriving and leaving, everything. There's not any second that there's not arriving and leaving with any sound, with any sound, with any sensation, with any thought, with anything. In Jinshin Jutsu, they talk about the work in the human life as being about letting go. And that we get it wrong. We think that our work is to get, to accumulate, to learn things.